saving money on your next project with help from Menards. Be prepared for flooding and keep your basement dry with Barracuda Pumps. Barracuda makes high-quality pumps that offer dependable performance for when you need it most. Save big money on all Barracuda Pumps now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for Pod 25, Little Lamb. Tonight, we're on the case in Port Arthur, Texas, 90 miles east of Houston. The industrial Gulf Coast city became the setting for a heartbreaking murder when a young mother was found shot to death in her own SUV. The puzzling crime scene left investigators with a lot of questions and few answers. In fact, it would take years to unravel the mystery of what really happened on that desolate stretch of highway. May 14th, 2010. It was 9 p.m. on a quiet night in Port Arthur until police received a call from a distraught couple. They had just found their neighbor, Allison Clark, and her SUV stranded in the roadway. When the couple recognized the vehicle, they immediately pulled over to help their neighbor. Investigator Michael Hebert.
The vehicle was stationary. They noticed that her hazard lights were flashing, so they just assumed she was having car trouble.
But when they approached the SUV to offer assistance, they realized the situation was far worse than they ever could have imagined. As they inched closer, a horrifying scene came into focus.
Allison slumped over with a large amount of blood.
The couple was in shock. It was clear the young mother was dead, and their horror grew when they noticed that Allison's three-year-old daughter was in the back seat. Texas Ranger Ken Parks.
There were some patrol deputies that arrived on the scene moments later that just happened to be in the area. And they said the child was asleep in the car seat when they got there.
Miraculously, the toddler appeared to be unharmed.
And they removed her out of the vehicle.
Port Arthur police arrived minutes later.
When police officers first arrived on scene, they found a large SUV in the middle lane. The driver of the vehicle was slumped over the console.
Patrol Officer Angela Scroggins immediately noticed clear signs that the 24-year-old mother's death was no accident.
When I approached the vehicle, there was a bullet hole in the driver window.
The bullet had shattered the glass on the driver's side window. Investigators scoured the scene for additional evidence and quickly came to the conclusion that it had been a single gunshot that killed the young mother.
One shot only.
The evidence indicated the bullet had been fired from outside the SUV and hit Allison in the left side of her chest.
I did immediately see a bullet wound directly to the entrance of her left armpit, just directly above it. I looked around in the back seat behind her, and I saw an exit wound that told me that the bullet had traveled at an angular direction through her body.
The large bullet was ultimately located, lodged in the far side of the driver's seat.
We knew it was either a .40 caliber or a 10 millimeter.
Those on the scene couldn't help but think about how it was a miracle that the toddler in the back seat hadn't been killed.
It's a very heavy bullet. It does major destruction at close range.
Investigators immediately sent the slug to the state crime lab for analysis.
and ballistics testing on that bullet revealed another important detail.
It was fired from a Glock pistol.
While the cause of Allison's violent death had been obvious, the motive would be far more difficult to figure out.
Detectives initially wondered if the murder had been a robbery gone wrong, but evidence at the crime scene indicated otherwise.
Her purse was laying in the front floorboard, and next to that purse was a $10 bill with a drop of blood on it. They didn't take that $10 or her purse, so there was no evidence that robbery was the motive.
Police found Allison's cell phone on the floor as well. It seemed clear that she had been trying to call for help as she was dying.
Even seasoned investigators were taken aback by the callousness of the crime.
She was a young mother with a small child in the vehicle when it happened. Tears your heart out, honestly.
Adding to the horror, police believe that based on the position of Allison's body, she had been trying to get to her daughter as she was dying.
She was being a mother to the end, reaching for a small child that was in the back seat of the car.
While investigators' emotional reactions only deepened their resolve to find Allison's killer, police had little else to go on.
They meticulously processed Allison's car, hoping to find a clue that could lead them to her killer. But the search came up empty.
We didn't retrieve any DNA. We didn't retrieve any fingerprints.
I could not come up with any theory as to why the shooting occurred. It didn't appear to be a robbery. You've got a mother driving by herself on a very desolate area. And she's got her toddler in the vehicle with her. Just really didn't make any sense.
But detectives did find evidence that helped them understand how the crime unfolded.
I began to look for shattered glass on the roadway. I probably walked 100 feet north of her vehicle, showing possibly where the impact had occurred prior to her coming to a stop.
Ultimately, the trail of glass shards ended more than 500 feet away, indicating that the SUV had likely rolled to a stop.
I believed that when the bullet hits the window, that glass falls, and then trinkles of glass will fall all the way to Allison's stopping point.
It also confirmed investigators' theory that Allison was driving when she was shot.
I always wonder if Allison even knew she was shot. I'm sure she went into shock immediately. We don't know exactly how fast Allison was going, but she was able to stop the car, put it in park, and then put her hazard lights on. And that was all for her child, no doubt.
Mortally wounded, her final moments of life were spent trying to protect her daughter.
It was very sad how she must have felt knowing that her child's in the back seat. She had the mindset to try to protect her child, which I thought was very, very awesome.
A canvas at the area revealed no witnesses to the shooting.
You're always taught, follow your evidence, follow your evidence. Well, in this case, we had very little evidence. Investigators will go into theories because a lot of times, that's all you have. Could this have happened? Could this have happened? And so you kind of follow those things when you have no evidence.
Still, police knew the next step of the investigation would be the most difficult. Informing Allison's family about the tragedy. Investigators weren't able to get in touch with Allison's husband, but eventually spoke with her brother, Corey. He shared the heartbreaking news with his mother, Sharon.
I was at work. I worked 7 to 7 at a hospital, and I got a call for my son. And I could tell something was majorly wrong. He was crying. He was so upset. And he told me, Mom, Allison's dead. She was on West Port Arthur Road. Something came through her window and killed her. We didn't know at the time that she was shot.
When Port Arthur police spoke with Allison's loved ones, they heard nothing but kind words about the loving young wife who had dedicated herself to raising her two young daughters, ages 3 and 1. The two little girls had been the center of her world, and Allison thrived in her role as their mom.
Oh, Allison was a great mother. She was very attentive, very patient. She was a good teacher. Cadence knew her ABCs, her numbers, her colors, her shapes, everything at 3 years old. That was her life.
Allison had built a wonderful life with her family, and the future was bright.
They were happy. She eventually wanted to go back to school to be a teacher, and they wanted another child.
For her mother, losing Allison was almost unbearable. Allison was her only daughter, and they shared an unbreakable bond.
We were very close. She was my baby.
Allison's mother couldn't think of anyone who would have wanted to hurt her. She was well-liked and had no personal problems with anyone.
I didn't think it was somebody she knew, because she didn't have no enemies.
While her family began to plan Allison's funeral, police were still looking for their first lead. The young mother's autopsy only seemed to confirm what police already knew.
She was struck with a bullet that entered her left upper arm, passed through both lungs, severed her aorta, and then exited out her right shoulder and lodged in the seat.
But when Texas Ranger Ken Parks carefully studied the autopsy photos, he made a critical discovery. A stippling burn.
Normally on a gunshot victim, we will not work any kind of residue because they all have residue. But when they have stippling is unburned gunpowder. All the powder doesn't burn up when the bullet comes out. And it will strike something. If it's within 3 to 5 feet, it'll actually burn their skin. And I saw that on her arm. And it made me wonder, with the window rolled up, and then she's in a moving vehicle, how was that possible?
There was only one plausible explanation.
Had to be a very close range shot.
The new information helped police eliminate many theories of the crime.
It ruled out the possibility that it was just a stray bullet from somebody target practicing, shooting at cars, even two vehicles approaching one another on that highway. All those things got ruled out.
In fact, it left investigators with one chilling conclusion.
A vehicle pulled up, traveling the same speed as her, and the gun was in very close proximity to her driver's window.
This was up close and personal. So that was a break for us. That was really the first break in the case that we got.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. The close-range shot led detectives to ask a critical question. Did someone know that Allison would be on the dark stretch of road that night? Police turned their attention to her husband, Josh Clark. When investigators questioned Josh, he was cooperative. But his demeanor was not what they expected from a man who had just been told his wife had been murdered. Texas Ranger Ken Parks.
He appeared somewhat emotionally detached, not the type of emotion that you would perceive someone have with such a tragedy.
Detectives, trying to piece together a timeline, asked him, when he had last seen his wife that day.
Investigator Michael Hebert.
She was headed off to a store, and she was going to bring one of the girls.
Josh told police that he had stayed at home babysitting their youngest daughter while Allison was out shopping.
Investigators asked Josh if there was someone who could verify his whereabouts that night.
One of the babies was there, and he was babysitting, and then Josh's brother was also in the house.
But when detectives questioned Josh's brother, he was unable to prove that Josh had been in the house with him the entire night.
He had shut his door. He was watching a movie, and he said he had the TV turned up, so there was no solid alibi.
Detectives also knew that it had taken some time to get in touch with Josh following the murder.
Police tried to call him several times that night, but the calls went unanswered.
Josh claimed that he had logged on to a computer game called Atlantica. He was wearing headphones at the time. He saw one of the phone calls from his brother-in-law. He decided not to answer it, but when they called back a couple more times, then he finally answered.
Police believe that gap in time without a response was very suspicious.
About 40 minutes had elapsed that he can't alibi himself for, and it was at that time when Allison was killed.
Those on the case were suspicious of his story.
Why aren't you picking your phone up, and are you not picking your phone up because you're not inside your house?
Josh's comments to investigators raised even more concerns.
One of the detectives asked him if he was right-handed or left-handed. And he stated that I'm right-handed, and then interjected, but I shoot a gun left-handed.
There was something about that answer that gave detectives pause.
Nobody has mentioned a gun.
And that was not the only statement Josh made that raised eyebrows.
One question I asked, if he had killed Allison, what would he have done with a murder weapon? And he thought and said, on the way back to the house, I think I would have thrown it in the canal.
The answer stunned detectives.
If I'm being asked that question by a Texas Ranger and my wife had been murdered, my first response would have been, well, number one, I didn't kill my wife, so I can't even answer that question. That was a red flag.
Police then asked Josh to take a polygraph test, and he agreed.
But the results did little to advance the investigation.
The exam was declared inconclusive. He showed some deception on one of the questions.
And it had been a critical question.
The question was, do you know who killed Allison?
When Josh's answer to that crucial question indicated deception on his polygraph test, it firmly secured him as the prime suspect in the case. Josh remembers feeling overwhelmed when detectives began questioning him about his wife's untimely death.
I was starting basically the robot mode at that point. Your body almost goes into autopilot.
It quickly became apparent to Josh that the detectives were not treating him like a grieving husband, but a suspect in his wife's murder.
It was like 5 or 6 questions in that I started feeling that way. One of them was actually telling me, I think you did it. I think you're the one that did it. And then I do remember saying in my head, you better watch yourself to go put you in jail.
Josh concedes that his lack of an alibi didn't help.
His brother had been in his house that night, but couldn't prove that Josh had been home the whole time.
He didn't know if I stayed in the room. He didn't know if I went outside.
And Josh's remarks heightened
investigators' concerns. When asked where he would dispose of the murder weapon if he had committed the crime, Josh gave police a chillingly specific answer.
They were asking me kind of shotgun questions at this point. Where would you think would be the best spot to ditch a weapon? I don't know. There's a canal right around the corner. I guess drive by it, throw it in there.
It was a damning statement. Just days later, police began dredging that very canal.
The DPS dive team would come and they would immediately start. They do a grid path.
As the investigation continued to intensify, detectives remained bothered by Josh's lack of emotion and the obvious statement he had never made. In his interviews with police, he never said, "I had nothing to do with killing Allison." That was troubling to investigators. If he in fact was innocent, why wouldn't he adamantly deny being involved in her death?
What would that have helped? Anytime you see anybody that's guilty, what do they say? "I'm innocent. I didn't do it." So if my first response is, "I didn't do it," they're going to say, "Hey, there is a usual response we're used to. He did it."
Police also focused on Josh's shaky alibi and had investigators perform a forensic search of his computer.
They were looking to see if he was online at that time.
Joshua told police he was playing a video game at home on his computer and had headphones on. He claimed he never heard his phone ring. A forensic examination of his computer confirmed that someone was online using that computer at the time that Allison was killed. But detectives had no way of confirming if Josh was actually playing the game. And investigators continued to dig, taking a hard look at the rumors that there had been trouble in the couple's marriage. Josh claimed their marriage had been a good one, and beyond small disagreements that any couple would have, they were happy.
The only thing we ever argued about was money. That's the usual argument. That's the only thing we had little minute spats about. Other than that, it was a great marriage.
After a thorough investigation, detectives found nothing in the couple's background that suggested there was any kind of abuse or infidelity. And there was nothing to indicate that Josh had any motive for the crime. Meanwhile, the dive team's search of the canal also came up empty.
They would enter the water and they did not find any firearms.
Police began to consider the possibility that Josh might be telling the truth. But there was still the unexplained failed polygraph exam. Why would an innocent man fail a polygraph test?
The exact question was, "Do you know who killed Allison Neal Clark?" In my head, I was thinking gangs did. But on a polygraph, you can either answer yes or no. My answer was no.
Investigators asked him to take a second exam.
They changed that question slightly. We asked, "Did you kill Allison?" And he passed.
Investigators had taken a long, hard look at Josh, but ultimately concluded that he had not been involved in Allison's murder, and he was cleared.
We had no evidence that ever supported him having anything to do with Allison's murder.
And the end of the investigation into him meant Josh could finally mourn the loss of his wife.
It was from, "Hey, everybody's looking at you," to, "Hey, we're here. Let us help you."
Detectives had originally described him as emotionally detached, but Josh felt he needed to be strong for his two small daughters. It was only in private moments that he allowed himself time to grieve.
Showers. Well, you put the kids to sleep, and then take your shower. And that's your time, you know what I mean?
Detectives clearing Josh also gave Allison's family much-needed peace of mind. Allison's mother, Sharon Neal.
What a big relief. Big weight taken off my shoulder.
But that sense of relief was quickly replaced by a desperate search for answers. Who would have wanted to kill the young mother while sparing her child? From the beginning, it seemed more like a big city crime than the type they'd expect to see in Port Arthur. And that had investigators wondering if the killer might have been just passing through town that night. Port Arthur was right off the interstate and not far from bigger cities where crime was more prevalent.
It's not uncommon for people from Houston to come in and commit robberies in Port Arthur, and they're back in Houston in an hour and a half, so that crossed our minds.
Police also turned to the public for help, asking anyone with information to come forward.
The media was a benefit to us initially because they got it out to the public.
And the hard work paid off with a crucial tip. A man reported that he had heard gunfire on the night Allison had been killed, not far from the crime scene.
This is the gas station where a witness was filling up his vehicle when he heard gunshots and saw a silver Ford truck.
Although the witness didn't have many details, detectives believe the lead was promising. But the details provided made it plausible that whoever had shot the gun could have also shot and killed Allison.
They were firing a gun out of the window within a 15-minute time frame when she was shot.
In addition to the timing, the proximity of the gas station to the crime scene only added to investigators' suspicions.
About 4 miles.
Texas Ranger Ken Parks immediately made a trip to the gas station. He was elated when he saw that the station had cameras facing the roadway.
We were able to obtain video surveillance of the Ford trucks that passed the gas station. However, due to the poor quality of the video, we were unable to make out a license plate.
Despite the grainy video, police noticed another car that had been pulling into the gas station as the silver truck went by.
I said, there's a car right beside it when he's supposedly shooting, and it's a gold PT Cruiser. And I asked the store owner, I said, do you know that guy? He's a regular customer. He pulled into the store as the truck's come along. The PT Cruiser's right beside it. He shoots. The PT Cruiser pulls into the store and he goes on by.
Finally, police believe they had a witness who could advance the investigation.
So we went and identified that witness. He had not come forward.
The driver of the gold car confirmed the original witness's story about the gunshots.
He said, oh, yeah, I remember it well. He said, I scared the hell out of me. I thought they were shooting at me. I said, could you tell who was driving it? He said, no. It's got real dark, dark tinted windows. You can't even see if there's one person or 10 people in it.
Armed with new information, law enforcement sprung into action.
We put an alert out to all county law enforcement in our area Patrol is the bread and butter of any police department, and they're on the streets 24/7, so that's what they were looking for. They were making traffic stops on what we believed was a Ford F-150 gray to silver pickup truck.
But when investigators checked county registrations for Ford F-150s, they discovered that it was an even more popular model truck than they had imagined.
We pulled from 1999 to 2001 date range. We had somebody at Ford look at the very grainy pictures, and he said, oh, he knew it had to be in that date range. Just in that date range were over 450. Just in that county, that's not counting all the contractors. It's like finding a needle in a stack of needles.
Still, investigators did their best to locate the truck.
We spent lots of man hours, lots of time trying to track that down, hoping that somebody at some point in time would say, hey, I know somebody that drives a truck like that, and y'all might want to look at them. We looked at a lot of them.
But the weeks turned into months and then years. During that time, Allison Clark's murder slowly faded from the headlines.
The case died in the media, but it didn't die in that office. For years, we were going to turn every stone over that we could, and we were looking for that one break.
More on The Case, the podcast, after this. Investigators who spent countless hours trying to solve Allison Clark's murder were frustrated, and the team knew they were going to have to get a break if they were ever going to solve it. Investigator Michael Hebert.
You have to understand that when everything went cold, we weren't receiving any more letters, nothing, no tips, nothing. So that's where we were at that point. We were looking for the needle in the haystack, and we must have done hundreds of interviews about Allison.
The case had been stalled for years when a tip came in that suddenly reignited the investigation.
An informant overheard two individuals talking about the Westport Arthur Road homicide. That was the break that we have waited for years in this case.
The two individuals the informant named, Ozzie Ibarra and Sabino Pino Martinez, were well known to law enforcement in Port Arthur.
Assistant United States Attorney Leslie Woods.
Two completely cold and morally bankrupt violent criminals.
Texas Ranger Ken Parks found an important potential connection to Allison's murder buried deep in Ozzie Ibarra's rap sheet.
I found that Ozzie Ibarra had been arrested in Groves, Texas, less than a month after Allison's death. I went and pulled up the photographs that they had taken of that robbery, and Ozzie Ibarra was driving a gray Ford extended cab truck. Bells and whistles went off.
The gray truck appeared to be a match to the one captured on the gas station videotape on the night of Allison's murder. Ranger Parks was then able to track down the truck itself. It had been sold to a new owner who agreed to allow investigators to search it.
Everything matched 100%. It was the same make, year, model, color, same wheels, everything. I was like, that's it. This case is finally coming together.
Police were disappointed when a forensic search of the truck turned up no evidence. Then the owner made an offhand remark that changed everything.
She said, you know, my husband, he cleaned that truck up when we bought it. He may remember something. Later that night, I got a call, and it was her saying that her husband had found a shell casing in that truck and had kept it. I was ecstatic.
The shell casing was submitted for ballistic testing. detectives held their breath, hoping that the testing would reveal that the casing found in the truck was connected to Allison's murder.
It was the correct caliber, 10 millimeter.
Port Arthur police were now certain they were finally on the right track and intensified their investigation into Ozzy Ibarra and his friend, Sabino Martinez. It turned out they had been committing crimes together for years.
Investigator Alton Bays.
They were involved in robberies all over the area, terrorizing neighborhoods.
They had shoved guns in people's faces, and they didn't care if they only got out of there with $10 or $20. They were just trying to get money to go buy more drugs, and they didn't care who they hurt or how they got it.
And there was another stunning detail. All of the victims of the crime spree had been female.
That was their main target. When they would see a woman alone, they felt like she was helpless, and they referred to her as a little lamb. And that was their MO for most of the robberies that they conducted. If they weren't doing an armed robbery, they looked for a little lamb in the community.
Could Allison Clark have been one of those little lambs? The circumstantial evidence was compelling, but not enough to make an arrest. Then investigators got an unexpected break when Ibarra's girlfriend, Jessica Bellis, was arrested on an unrelated fraud charge.
Jessica would run around with Ozzy and Pino. She drove them everywhere they went in that gray truck.
Jessica had essentially been a de facto designated driver for Ozzy and Pino.
Probably because they were so messed up and high that they couldn't do it.
Bellis agreed to speak with detectives, and over the course of many conversations, a terrifying story slowly began to emerge.
She put it all together. That interview was riveting. I couldn't believe after all these years that I had heard what I had just heard.
Bellis told police she had been behind the wheel of Ozzy Ibarra's silver truck on a dark Friday night. Her boyfriend's partner, Pino Martinez, was in the passenger seat when suddenly she heard a gunshot.
I'm driving, I hear pow.
Okay.
And the window
okay.
is open. I remember seeing a young girl, a young female.
She says, as I begin to pass, Sabino fired the shot.
Pino shot that girl on West Port Arthur Road.
Bella said after the shot was fired, she was ordered to turn around. She pulled the truck behind Allison Clark's SUV, which had drifted to a stop with its hazard lights on.
At that point, they told her to stop. She says that Sabino and Ozzy are yelling at each other. Sabino ran around the front of her truck, looked in briefly to Allison's window, and then walked around to the passenger side of the car.
He was saying something about a baby in the back.
Bellis gave police other critical details that only someone involved in the murder could have known.
Jessica, do you remember how close you were driving to it?
If I stick my hand out the window, I reach a little bit more, I'm touching her rearview mirror. It's that close.
Bellis's description of the close-range shot explained how Allison had been burned by the gunpowder residue.
The vehicles were approximately this close when Sabino Martinez extended his arm and shot Allison through her driver's side window.
I remember stepping out of the room, and I think I was shaking. This was a career case for a lot of us. And I remember when I opened that door, Ken Parks and Leslie Woods were standing there, and we group hugged. We couldn't believe it.
We're excited. My main thing is, I was relieved knowing that we were finally going to give Allison's family some closure.
After speaking with Jessica Bellas, detectives approached Ozzy Ibarra behind bars.
What's up, man?
And he confirmed her account while placing all of the blame on his partner, Pino Martinez.
I just remember hearing somebody shoot some commotion. What's going on? What you doing? When I found out that there's a woman, an innocent woman with a baby, he did it. He needs to take it.
Although Martinez had fired the deadly shot, police remained convinced that Allison Clark had been targeted that night.
They wanted to scare her and get her to pull over so that they could rob her.
She's a single lady. She is a little lamb, and I think they were going to take advantage of that.
Despite the incriminating statements from Ibarra and Bellas, prosecutor Leslie Woods believed their testimony might not be enough to convict Sabino Martinez.
I found myself reading every violent crime law that I could find in the federal code, trying to find a way to hold them accountable.
Assistant U.S. Attorney Leslie Woods ultimately chose a unique path to justice. She took advantage of federal laws that allowed her to combine Allison's murder with the series of armed robberies Martinez and Ibarra were accused of committing.
They were charged with participating in a robbery conspiracy, and then one of the overt acts of their conspiracy was that they killed Allison. It's akin to felony murder.
And once those charges against Ibarra and Martinez were filed, it was time to tell Allison's family about the arrest.
It was just wall-to-wall people. People began to weep. The family members began to cry.
For Josh Clark, the emotional gathering was a moment of vindication.
It was a look that I'll never forget. I cannot imagine what this man went through for those years.
Ozzy Ibarra agreed to plead guilty to the charges against him in exchange for a 35-year sentence. But his partner, Sabino Martinez, turned down the plea deal.
Detective Paul Arviso.
The U.S. Attorney, Leslie Woods, offered him something equivalent to what Ozzy Ibarra received. Sabino sent word back saying he will not accept anything with a 3 in front of it.
The case went to trial on April 24th, 2017.
We knew that it was going to be a fight, but there comes a point in time when we believed we had the right person, we believed we had enough evidence to put it in front of a jury, and Allison deserved to have her day in court.
Prosecutors believe their best chance for a conviction rode on the testimony of Jessica Bellas.
Jessica was huge. Jessica actually was in the truck.
But the trial's most dramatic moment was a surprise when Sabino Martinez decided to take the stand in his own defense.
I got an opportunity to cross-examine Sabino Martinez, and I think that was a turning point that helped us get justice in this case.
During the cross-examination, Martinez labeled Jessica Bellas as a snitch, a description prosecutors were able to use against him.
And I said, would you agree with me that only guilty people have snitches? And he said yes.
It was a shocking blunder.
I think he realized right after the fact, but the damage was done. He made a huge mistake.
In spite of his huge gaffe, Martinez's demeanor remained unaffected and defiant.
He just sat up there like he was untouchable.
But in the end, the jury found him guilty. And instead of the 35-year term he was offered in the plea deal, the judge sentenced Martinez to 80 years in prison.
After we got the jury verdict, I just cried for about 2 hours straight. I don't think I've ever taken a case that personally.
Josh Clark is incredibly grateful to Leslie Woods for all of the hard work she put into the case. And surprisingly, he holds no grudges against law enforcement.
What does it help? All it does is brings you down, you know? It doesn't help anything.
Instead, Josh focuses his attention on his and Allison's two beautiful daughters.
Because it ultimately revolves around them. They're the future of her memory. Raise them to be like their mom, and they'll be awesome people. Change the world.
Michaela and Cadence are now 11 and 13. Allison's daughter, Michaela Clark.
I try to act like how they've told me she was like.
Allison's daughter, Cadence Clark.
She was all about kindness and honesty, and of course, we were her world.
Both young girls are blessings for Allison's mother, but also reminders of what she has lost.
I have a swing. I sit out on my patio, and every morning, here she come on her bicycle. Michaela would be on the back, and Cadence would be on her little training wheel bicycle. I have to say I miss that so much.
Following the trial, Acting U.S. Attorney Britt Featherston thanked the tenacious team of dedicated investigators and Assistant U.S. Attorney Leslie Woods for their tireless work in bringing Allison's killer to justice. Congratulations on a job well done. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.